Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to the Bangor Public Library with the League of Women Voters of Maine for a talk by Ben Riley. He joins us from Murdoch University in Australia, where he's the Dean of the School of Public Policy and International Affairs. The title of today's talk is What Australia's Experience with Ranked Choice Voting Can Teach Maine. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website. Just go to mainepublic.org, click on radio to hear this program again at your convenience, and while you're there, you can find many other past Speaking in Maine programs. And as always, you can find it as a podcast. Taking the stage now is Dr. Ben Riley, Speaking in Maine.
Thank you very much to the League of Women Voters, thanks to the University of Maine, big thanks to Amy who kind of made a lot of this happen, to the library. It's really great to be here. I've never been to Maine before. I've always wanted to. I remember reading John Irving books and stuff as a kid. Like, wow, that sounds so great. I'd love to go there. I'm a political scientist, and the reason I'm here is that I work on ranked choice voting. And I actually wrote my PhD many moons ago with support from the United States Institute of Peace and other places on the use of ranked choice voting in new democracies that were facing ethnic and other kinds of deep division. And I never imagined there would be a way to connect this with the United States, but as a result of what you've done here in Maine, this has become a very, it's significant in its own right, and it's potentially very significant if this starts a reform wave. So 2018 is a big year for ranked choice voting, and I was attending a conference down in Boston, and so this is a great opportunity to come up. There's another reason 2018 is a big year for ranked choice voting, and that's because it's the 100th anniversary of our use of the system in Australia at the national level. Almost to the day. So we've been using the system that you've adopted, the ranked choice voting in single member electorates, now for 100 years, and even a little bit longer in some states. And so given that, we thought it might be useful to just look briefly at the Australian experience and try and contrast it a little bit with some of the potential issues that might come up in Maine. I know nothing and don't want to really know anything about your politics, although I've heard a few things. but this is really not about the partisan impacts of the system here. There will be partisan impacts, presumably, but I'll leave that for the people of Maine to talk about if that's of interest. And I'll just talk about really how it's worked in Australia and maybe what some of the implications might be for Maine. And I'll be very happy to take questions as well. We make people vote in Australia. It's compulsory to vote. So that's something that I don't think that's going to be adopted here in America anytime soon. I'd be surprised. So we make people vote, and people actually use a pencil to fill in. That's different to yours. I'll have a look at the ballot papers in a second. They actually vote by ranking on the ballot paper these numbers. Now, I thought I'd show you this. This is actually one of many attempts by our Electoral Commission to explain ranked choice voting. Right? And this is an issue that is going to be an issue in Maine, for sure. There's been different approaches. I'm going to show you some successful approaches and some not so successful approaches. I quite like this one because it shows something that's really important if you want to grasp how the system works, which is that it shows ballot papers actually being transferred. Right? So here's, and this is exactly the same for your system, right? Here's how it works. let's say we have three candidates. In this case, we have Fred, Ben, and Anna. You have 60,000 ballot papers in total. So there's 60,000 votes in the count. Under ranked choice voting, you need to get an absolute majority of those ballot papers, right? So even though normally Ben would have won the election under a straight plurality contest, he doesn't have 50% plus one, so he doesn't have 30,000 votes. So if anyone had 30,000 votes, the election would be over, right? The rankings, the second choice votes only come into play if no one gets an absolute majority on the first round. But remember, an absolute majority is a much higher threshold than most candidates in most real-world elections here in the US and elsewhere are winning these days under plurality rules, because a lot of people, as we get more and more fragmentation, are winning with, you know, 30% of the vote, 25% of the vote. I've seen less, you know. So one way of thinking of that is that if they're winning with that much, they're essentially being rejected by 70%, 75%, 80% of the people. So that's the problem that ranked choice voting seeks to address. And it does it by asking for people's second choices. It just says to voters, tell us your first choice, and then also tell me who your candidate would be. If you can't have your first choice, who is your second choice of candidate? And if you can't have either of them, what would your third choice be? And so on. But, you know, in real world elections, most people don't have, often it's three, maybe four. In San Francisco, I think they limit it to three. So, you know, you can rank fourth choices and fifth choices and so on if you want. All right. So you elicit that information from voters. Then at the count, if no one has a majority, the candidate with the lowest number of first choice votes is eliminated. Okay? So in this case, poor old Fred. Fred only got 15,000 votes. So Fred can't win the election. No way. Fred is the candidate who is eliminated from the count. And they take Fred's ballot papers and they actually look at the second choices. For all the people who voted for Fred, well, what's the second choice? In this case, of the 15,000 people who voted for Fred, 5,000 had a second choice for Anna, for Ben, I'm sorry, and 10,000 had a second choice for Anna. So they physically, if you can imagine, they're physically moving the ballot papers from there onto Ben's pile. 5,000 of them go onto Ben's pile. 10,000 of them go onto Anna's pile. And Anna's, as a result, Anna, who started off with 22,000 first preference votes, first choice votes, has picked up an additional 10,000 second choice votes. She's the winner. That's how ranked choice voting works. That's how it will work here. Of course, the ballot papers look different, but the actual way of counting is the same. You use voting machines, so you know, there's a lot of differences in terms of the mechanics, in terms of the optics, but the basic mechanics is the same. Now, here is another way. This is on the internet, I just found. Here's another way of thinking about the cycle. So this is just another way of presenting exactly the same, but in a more schematic way. You count voters' first choices. Does a candidate have a majority, right? Not a plurality, a majority, absolute majority. Yes, game over, that's it. And lots of elections end that way. The second choices don't come into it. Doesn't matter, they don't get counted, no one cares. No, eliminate the last place candidate, re-examine their ballot papers, see who voted for this last place candidate, what their second choice is, send them back. Then ask the same question again. Does someone have a majority now? No. Keep going. So you're going to eliminate another candidate now. And I'll show you another example of this soon, just to... But that's another way of thinking about it. So it can be a cycle, and you can go through this cycle over and over until you get someone with a majority, or until there's only two candidates left, and then you one of them's going to be the winner. So it can go on a bit, these elections. They can, normally they don't, but in some cases where you have a lot of candidates and no one has a majority, it can take some time. Yes, ma'am.
In the primaries, that we sometimes have a lot of candidates.
Yeah.
Does that happen in...
We don't have primaries.
We don't have primaries. So how do you pick who your candidates are going to be?
The parties.
The parties.
Yeah, yeah. We don't. The parties make a choice. That we don't have the formal primary process you have here, which, yeah, is the American primary process is quite distinctive. There's not many countries that have it. Yeah.
How many parties do you have?
Well, we have lots of parties. We have two big ones. Like America, one, you know, a left and a right, and a lot of smaller ones. And I'll come to that in a minute too, because some of those smaller parties, the relationship between them and the big ones under ranked choice voting can get very interesting. Okay, so use it if it's useful. Now, just to remind you, this is how our ballot looks, very different to yours, and this is an interesting instruction. The Electoral Commission, they make people express preferences in Australia. Again, don't do that. I know you're not going to do that anyway, but it's a useful instruction because under ranked choice voting, you get the most power out of your vote by using the rankings. There is no downside in ranking candidates. It can never hurt your first choice candidate. There's nothing bad can happen from expressing those rankings, those second and third choices. So it's a good idea, and this is really more for the electoral administrators, but to try and encourage people to use their rankings, because the more information you can elicit from voters about their political preferences, the better the system will work. Okay, so in Australia, they go a bit overboard because most people probably don't have a fully formed set in their head of, you know, five rankings between all the candidates. But it's a good idea to try and do it. This is your ballot paper, of course, or this was the one that I was able to find. Actually, I think this is probably a better model in that I think it's a bit more intuitive to just have, you know, what's your first choice, what's your second choice, third choice, and so on. I'd say the only problem with this sort of ballot paper is if you get a lot of candidates, it's like a big, you know, big spreadsheet or something. From what I've seen of the upcoming congressional and Senate elections, you know, not too many candidates. The ballot papers will be smaller. You'll have three or four choices, and I think it's quite intuitive. So that's good. All right, so just a bit of an overview. What are the benefits of using this kind of electoral system? There's a couple of just really obvious ones. Getting a majority. So having a winning candidate who can say, I was elected by an absolute majority of my voters, either outright on first preferences or after we went through the count. In Australia, that's very important to politicians. I've had many politicians say this to me, you know, when I'm arguing with them about something, they're like, hey, I was elected with an absolute majority of my, you know, I know what people think. And really, it's important. We are also, like you, a big country. I come from a state that is three times the size of Texas. I like to remind Texans. And you know, it also helps that, you know, under this system, you can't just get elected from one part of the state and totally neglect the other part. So it has a regional balance dimension to it, which is important. So that's probably the main benefit. The other big one is that you're not rewarded for having split an opponent's vote. And of course, this happens a lot. I know it's happened here in Maine. It happens everywhere, where there might be several parties that are kind of close to each other ideologically or, you know, draw on a common pool of supporters, And if you can split them, then under plurality voting, you can come through and win with maybe 30% of the vote, even though 70% of the electorate clearly would rather they had someone else. That disappears largely under this system, as long as people use their rankings. So that's a benefit. And then there's a couple of the Australian experience, we found a couple of unexpected benefits or small benefits. Incentives for political collaboration. In Australia, the parties have learned that if they want to maximise their chances of winning a seat, it's a very good idea for them to reach out to other parties who they have some common connections with and make a deal for these second choice votes. And they don't normally do it terribly publicly. Sometimes it's very public, but mostly it's backroom, right? And they reach out and they say, what if we tell our supporters to give you their number two if you tell your supporters to give their number two vote to me? And they might, if there's a small party and a big party, the small party might try and extract some concessions on a policy issue, and I'll give you some examples. Just 1 minute, please. But that actually happens a lot behind the scenes. So that's very different, really, to the way politics is conducted under a plurality system where there's really no benefits in sitting down and having that discussion because you can't gain anything. Whereas under this system, you can gain by making deals with other parties. So it changes the incentive structure a little bit. In cases where you're using two rounds, it's not something you're using in Maine, but some places that do, you can save some money. And yeah, we've found overall in Australia, it tends to advantage centrists. For what that's worth, not everyone thinks that's an advantage. But it's very hard to get elected as an extremist candidate under this system, because you're not going to pick up any second preference votes from any other candidates if you're so extreme that, you know, you have your core of 20 or 30% who think you're great, but you horrify everyone else. This system is going to penalise you. This system will penalise you. It will, because you won't be able to pick up any of those second and third choice votes. Sorry, let me come back. Yeah.
So, I'm sorry. So essentially you're preventing polarization of politics, but how transparent is the process for the parties picking their candidates? And is that something that the public has any say in whatsoever?
Not very transparent. I'm not, certainly not putting the Australian political model up as something to emulate. It's just that we use the same electoral system. No, our process is not terribly transparent.
Would it work in a place like the US where we do elect our party's representatives?
Well, you're going to find out, right? I mean, you're using the system. you tell me. I mean, you used it for your primaries here. That seemed to go okay, as far as I could tell. I mean, I think, yeah, that's probably a question for someone who knows the local situation better. This system has been used in other parts of the US. It's been used historically. It's used for some major city elections for mayor and, you know, San Francisco and Minnesota, Berkeley, but, you know, a few smaller cities as well.
In Australia specifically, are there monitoring of like the public opinion of the system? Is that done by...
To be honest, we've used it for so long. Most Australians assume this is the way the whole world votes. And when they, you know, when some of our politicians go overseas and they go to, you know, England or somewhere and they come back and like, really weird electoral system, no preferences, you know? Yeah, no, there's no debate about changing this system in Australia because we've been using it for so long. Partly because it serves the interests of all the parties.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Dr. Ben Riley comes to us from Australia, a country that's been using ranked choice voting for nearly a century. He's helping Mainers paint a picture of what they can expect using the system this November.
I'm not going to give you any theory because I know you didn't come here for theory. But this is how political scientists tend to think that most voters are distributed between the extreme left-wing ideology, communism, and an extreme right-wing ideology, total libertarianism, no government, right? Most voters don't want communism. Most of them don't want no government at all. Most of them are in the middle. This electoral system finds that person. It's very good. It doesn't guarantee it, but it's much better than plurality. It tends to reward the person who is the median voter. Okay? Now, the median voter will differ whether you're in a very progressive part of the country, a very conservative part of the country. So the median voter in a very conservative part of the country is going to be pretty conservative. The median voter in a very progressive part of the country is going to be pretty progressive. The system tends to reward those who are in the middle of that spread of voters in any district. And that's one of the reasons why it tends to elect centrists. And again, it's hard on, it's tough on extremists. All right, that's all the theory. It's over. All right, from a voter's point of view, the voters don't need to know any of this stuff. They just need to know one thing. This is the most important thing for your average voter. I was staying in a hostel, actually, on the way up here, because I'm traveling by myself. I didn't want to just sit alone in a hotel room. So I stayed in a hostel in Portland. So I'm talking to lots of young people, mostly in their 20s, and I was telling them about this. And this is the thing they all like. This is from the UK, right? It's saying, here, these two parties are both doing well. So don't vote, if you're a Labour Party voter, don't vote for Labour because they can't win. You'll be wasting your vote, right? And this is part of the problem of plurality elections that have become ingrained. Don't vote for who you really like, because if they're a small party, you'll be wasting your vote. Choose between these two who you actually might not like that much. Ranked choice voting eliminates that problem. Go ahead and vote for, that's totally fine to vote for the party that's only polling 7%. Just then give your number two to whichever one of these you dislike least. And that really is, for most voters, that's actually how the system works. Choose whoever you like, and then, you know, whoever you dislike least out of the major parties, give your second choice to them, and that way you'll feel better, and people do. People feel more empowered when they get to vote their actual true preferences, but also your vote will have influence beyond just here. It will help to determine which of these two gets elected. So that's the key as far as most voters are concerned. And often you don't need to go past that for people to say, actually, that sounds good. That's an improvement. The one message that I want to get across is you don't waste your vote by voting who you really like. You can't waste your vote. This is a subject that can be made to be more complicated than it really is. And my advice to, and as I said, really a matter for the electoral administrators, because I assume there will be some kind of voter education campaign, but simple is better. So anyway, that's what not to do. All right, now I promised I don't want to bore you with sort of bizarre Australian facts, but we've used this system for 100 years, and one of the reasons we've used it for 100 years is that the very first time it was used, which is this time, this particular special election, what we call a by-election, it worked perfectly. And the government was so happy that they then introduced it nationally, and then everyone else started using it. So here's an example of how the partisan impacts. We had, back in 100 years ago, we had this party rising and becoming very powerful. They were the Workers' Party. Socialists, they were called. Okay. So you see on the first count, they got 42%. That would be enough in almost, all circumstances. That should get you an electoral victory. All of these other candidates were conservatives. They were all sort of connected in some way. They were all conservatives. The one thing they knew is that they really didn't like the socialists, and they wanted to stop the socialists. And here's an example of how the system can work in a situation where you have a group of parties trying to stop one, or a group of candidates trying to stop one other. Candidate Leeper only got 895 votes. So he is the first to be eliminated in this count. No one has a majority. You'll see his 895 votes go, almost all of them go to one of these three remaining candidates. Then the next candidate Coldham, is the next lowest. So this is the cycle that they go through. Has anyone got a majority yet? No. So we have to go to a third count. We will eliminate candidate Coldham. So his 1,286 votes are... I'm going to go over this side so I can see it properly. His 1,286 votes are redistributed. And again, most of them go to these two other conservatives. All right? The socialist gets hardly any. He goes from 42.9 to 43, gets a handful of votes. Nearly all of them go to the two other conservatives. Again, no one has a majority, so they have to do another round. And candidate Knox, another conservative, is the last to be eliminated, and nearly all of his votes go to the last standing conservative who wins. Okay? So that's an example. That was the very first time the system was used in Australia. And you had this disciplined preference trading between aligned candidates who were able to, in this case, successfully cooperate and coordinate and end up getting the result they wanted, which is they really didn't want this guy. That's what it all came down to. They wanted to stop this guy. So that's an example of how it can work. Obviously, that's a very partisan example, but it's 100 years ago. We don't care, right? But that's an example of how this kind of cooperation and aggregation can function. Yes, sir.
In recent elections in Australia, how many candidates were on the ballot?
Anywhere from 2 to 20.
2 to 20.
Yeah.
So if you had 20 candidates, Each voter would be required to place that candidate all the way out to 20.
Correct, a number from 1 to 20. And I'll show you how that process works in Australia. I don't think it's that relevant to Maine because you're not forcing anyone to express preferences. But
now, and if someone misses, it only goes to 17, their ballot is void.
Correct. Do not copy this model.
if there are among the candidates someone they really hate and this would be a terrible, terrible voice, they still have to vote for them.
Right. It's a good question. So in the Australian context, most people understand that if you put the candidate you hate last, then your vote effectively can never transfer to them, which is the case. So there's lots of campaigns, put Joe Bloggs last. Send him a message how much you hate him. He is the last choice. Now here, obviously, people just wouldn't vote for Joe Bloggs, right? But in the context of our system, that's how it works. So yes, people still want to feel that ability to really, express their dislike for Joe Bloggs, but under a full preferential system, that's how you do it.
I have a second question. Australia is a big country, and how long does it take you to determine a winner, typically?
On the night. We have a result on the night. Let me come back to that, if I may, at the end. The partisan impacts in Australia have changed dramatically since 1918. These days, the most important partisan aspect of ranked choice voting is preferences from the Greens Party, who are a minor party but a big one and growing all the time, to our centre-left party. So this is actually an example of that. This period from the 40s to about the 80s, the Conservatives benefited from ranked choice voting. Since then, more and more it's been the centre-left party, and that's happening because more and more they're getting second-choice votes from the Greens Party. And what's starting to happen now is that the Greens Party is starting to get so popular in some very progressive areas that they are outpolling the centre-left party, which means that the centre-left parties are now starting to elect the Greens, which is terrifying. The centre-left party, of course, the ALP, they're like, they were very happy about this system, and now they're like, ooh, hold on. But that's the way it works, right? They have a preference. So the Greens and the ALP have a preference-swapping deal. They will say to their supporters, you vote for us first, and then you put the ALP candidate number two, second, and the same thing happens in reverse. How do they do this in Australia? And this may happen in Maine. The parties hand out things, these pieces of paper outside the polling booth called how to vote cards. And they're like, basically say, copy this. Just copy this, right? And all the parties are there trying to get you to take one of their cards because they know that most voters aren't that interested, aren't that engaged. So they try and control. They say, make sure you vote for our person, number one. You notice they don't put anyone else's party affiliation. They don't want to advertise any of the other parties. They don't want to give any of the other parties any advantage. But they've obviously made a deal with this person for a second choice, maybe here. The others probably they don't care about, but they will be on the other side of politics. So that's how, in Australia, the parties try to control these flow of second choice votes. And I would imagine something similar. Obviously, it won't look like this, but there may be something similar happening here in Maine. Yeah. We get a result on the night, but we have thousands of people hand counting all the ballots, phoning the results in from every polling place to a central point for the district. The first choice votes for all candidates are then tallied centrally. Then they phone back to every polling place saying, eliminate this candidate, right? That's how they do it in Australia. It's very inefficient. It's replete with lots of errors because we don't use voting machines. I could tell you some stories about things that have gone wrong recently because, you know, we're trying to move hundreds of thousands of pieces of paper around. So actually, I think Maine, and I think now that the voting machine manufacturers have come on board for ranked choice voting and, you know, have as I understand it, are actually have created some fairly nifty voting machines, I think Maine has an opportunity to really jump and create probably the next generation of technology for ranked choice voting. And ideally, what you would have in a perfect world is that you'd have all these machines and they would be networked. So you could come up with a result pretty much instantaneously. That would be the new frontier. So if you guys get this right, then we'll probably end up borrowing it all back from you. Thanks very much, everyone. Thank you.
That's political scientist Ben Riley talking about ranked choice voting. Now it's time for the question and answer period. This is Speaking in Maine.
Yeah, I saw there was one, two, three hands.
Okay. How are the Russians going to hack your system?
So our system is unhackable, but it's also extremely expensive and error-prone because it relies on people. It's kind of probably outlived its natural lifespan because you can run elections this way when there's a couple of thousand, but when there's a couple of hundred thousand,
Carl, the next question is how... We must all be thinking about how are you going to have your computer, main how are you going to be sure that that's not hackable?
This is a question for the computer scientists more than for me. This is an issue that bedevils elections everywhere at present. Every time there's an attempt, particularly online elections, I wouldn't suggest going online. But if there's some kind of secure way to just network the voting machines, this is really for the future. I mean, this isn't for what's coming up in November. But I just think that's because ranked choice voting, you need to know which candidate to eliminate in the count, and that could be a different candidate from different polling stations. Right? That's the problem. So you need some way of centralizing the overall numbers of first choice votes for all candidates, seeing who comes last, and then redistributing their ballots. I think your system is going to be a lot better because you'll have that information on a computer chip, as I understand it, or on a thumb drive.
But there's also paper ballots with it. You do right. Your, and then so that I mean, as a, then they get a stack of paper ballots. Somebody could check later.
Right. Yeah. I think this is a big issue at present, the security of elections generally, because it turns out all sorts of things are hackable, things that we didn't even think were hackable.
So the deals that parties make with each other, now obviously you know that the outcome in terms of that they've saying we want this one, the second preference, the third preference, but do you know what it is that they have negotiated, like what the result of, you know, what the outcome of that would be?
Usually you do, yeah. Usually it's made explicit in the lead up to the election that so-and-so, these two parties have entered into a preference swapping deal. All that means is that they are suggesting to their supporters, right?
That's you know what policies or
yeah, usually
personnel.
Usually you do. Because usually the media is like, well, what's the basis of this deal that you've made? And they're like, oh, well, you know, we'll consider this smaller party's request for X, mm-hmm. you know, favorably if we're in government as big party Y. That typically it would be something like that. Some of the, I told you about this, the real strength of this environmental party's influence on our centre-left party. Sometimes that can get very explicit. You know, the centre-left party will say, okay, we promise to do these four environmental things. We promise we're going to have this emissions target, or, you know, we're going to expand this national park or whatever. Because they really want to, they know that if they don't get those second choice votes from people who are voting green, they're probably won't get into government. So they have a very strong incentive. But it's always a balancing act because parties, they don't like giving attention to other parties. And I'm sure it will be the same here. They won't want to advertise any more than they need to if they've done a deal. Like I said, we've been using this system for 100 years. It took some time for our parties to work out what the optimum strategies were. It didn't happen overnight. Yes.
Well, so I was just curious about the hand counting of paper ballots compared to what it's like in Maine. How many election jurisdictions do you have nationally?
So at the national level,
yeah,
150 districts.
Oh, okay.
And then at the state level, of course, a whole lot more. Yeah. But so it's smaller than the.
Yeah.
Yeah. We Australia is about the same size as the continental US, not including Alaska, just the Maine. But with only a tenth of the number of people. So that's, yes.
Has this system continued to grow the confidence in the governmental system?
That's a good question.
Or not?
Well, it's a good question. It's not an easy question to answer because our politicians are not well regarded. Like yours, you know, and trust has been in decline, as it is here. So we have challenges too. Having said that, most people would see ranked choice voting as being one of the strengths of a system that has many weaknesses. There's no move to get rid of it. And as I said, most Australian politicians kind of assume it's just sort of natural. So the one thing I would say is that we couldn't have produced some of the more extremist leaders that have been produced in the United States under our system. We have a different system in our Senate, where we do get some quite extremist views because it's elected differently. It's elected by proportional representation. So if you hear an Australian politician saying, you know, wild and wacky things, and nearly always a senator, and they're nearly always representing a, you know, a small segment of the community. The House of Representatives system, this ranked choice voting system, you know, most of the candidates who are elected are moderates for the reasons I spoke about earlier. So I would say it makes our politics rather boring by comparison with yours. There's a whole bunch of things it's not going to fix, but it is an improvement on plurality voting, I would say that. So, yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Has there ever been a study of how many candidates who won on the first ballot with the plurality then went on to lose because of ranked choice?
Yes, we know exactly how many. So in Australia, at the national level, it's approximately one in every 10 elections a candidate will come from second place, pretty much like that example I showed you from that election from 100 years ago. So one in every 10. Most, about two thirds of all seats are won by the candidate who was ahead on first choice votes, but they still need to count preferences because they don't get to the 50% mark. And then the other 20% or so are just won outright. So, yeah, about one in 10. That's with compulsory preferences. So I imagine if you were to transfer that to the main context or the US context, it probably wouldn't be as high as that. Yeah.
Who gets to vote? What are the citizen rights? Do you have to own a house? Do you have to live there so long? Can everyone vote?
Citizens.
So if you're not...
Over 18. Citizens over 18. And you require, you know, as I said, it's mandatory. So you have to enroll, although I don't know if it's really enforced, but, you know, when you get your driver's license, they put you on the electoral register and so on. And then you are obliged to vote.
Can you lose that right to vote?
No. Some, if you're a felon in some states, you lose it for a period of your imprisonment. If you're of unsound mind, you can be removed from the electoral roll. But that's pretty, there's fairly standard provisions in most democracies. No, I mean, there's no competition to try and restrict the franchise in Australia. And it can't be given that it's compulsory.
IDPs, to piggyback on that, what about IDPs? Are internally displaced peoples and refugees allowed to vote once they've been in the country for a period of time?
They need to be citizens.
Yeah. And what is the citizenship process, the length of that typically?
A little bit like yours, you know, you have to learn about the country and swear allegiance and go through quite a laborious process. It's not easy. Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me, does the election of the senators, for example, kind of help balance out for the people who are on the extremes? I mean, because otherwise I would think they could feel quite alienated.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's how it works. So we had an extremist party called One Nation pop up, you know, a decade or so ago, and they were saying right-wing extremism, so that, you know, they're saying nasty things about Aboriginals and they didn't like immigrants and they wanted to get out of the United Nations and, you know, sort of, and that was very appealing to 10% of the population, I guess. Now, that candidate, the two major parties deliberately decided that candidate, that party would not get any preference votes at all in the lower house. So they actually swap preferences with each other, which never happens, but they just decided this party's going to create problems for all of us. But then, of course, they did get elected in the Senate, and they now have a permanent, or it looks like a permanent place in our politics. So it's kind of a safety valve. I agree with you. I think that's your analysis is dead right. So they're there. We form our governments in the House of Representatives, though. So that's the key chamber, and that's the one that's elected by main-style RCV.
I read a novel once, I think it was In the Web, Neville Shute, maybe, and they talked about the proportional voting, and I read this, and I said, is that just something that the author has dreamed up?
No,
can you describe it?
So... ranked choice voting was originally invented in the UK back in the late 1800s or mid 1800s as a form of proportional representation. So it's like single member ranked choice voting, except you're electing multiple winners, and not only are you eliminating the lowest placed candidate to find out who wins, but if you're a winner who gets more votes than you actually require to win a seat, your surplus beyond what you won is transferred according to the second and third choices. Suffice to say that a lot of political scientists view it as the kind of ideal, mathematically and in terms of fairness, ideal electoral system. And I mean, we ended up with these systems just because that's what was in vogue when we federated, when we became a nation in 1901. Some people have suggested to me that if ranked choice voting and proportional representation, if these ideas had been around when the founding fathers were doing their thing here, because, you know, they were attracted to the new and the progressive, they probably would have, but they didn't exist. They didn't exist back in the late 1700s. Yeah. So it's partly just an accident of history that we ended up with it, but it has had a powerful influence on how our politics has developed over time. But it's taken a long time.
Yeah. A couple of questions and a comment. What in Maine is 38% of the population, the voters are independent. In the United States, 43% are independent. And we in Maine, we've got a number of, we have had a number of independent governors or senators, et cetera. Where does the independent fit in Australia?
Well, we have we're similar. So we have a couple of those 150 seats in our House of Representatives. I think there's five that are now held by independents. The popularity of the two major parties is decreasing over time. And if you're an independent, particularly in one of the more regional areas of the country, and you can run a strong local campaign, you have a good chance of getting elected. Ranked choice voting is an important part of the story there, because nearly always the major party candidate who comes second or third, they will direct, both of the major parties will be directing their supporters to give their second choice vote to the independent rather than elect their main enemy. So it can benefit. It benefits the independents as long as you've got these two parties who really don't want to see the other one win a seat. They'd always rather see the independent than their enemy. And yeah, so in our context, it has helped some of those independents to get elected.
If you could play devil's advocate for a second, and what's the, if you were against ranked choice voting, what would be the arguments that you would give us that we?
Well, as I said, you know, it is sometimes said with rightly that, you know, having a system where you're electing these moderate center, you know, whoever sits at the center, you know, that's going to create rather boring politics. And, you know, some people say we'd rather have, you know, really strong, you know, strong views than this, you know, whoever represents the middle of the electorate. I don't think that's a particularly strong argument, but it is more complex to count. And personally, I mean, I don't have a dog in the political fight here at all, but I do hope the elections go well administratively. I think that's going to be really important for the system continuing. There's lots of other places that are interested in this system in the US now, and I think just having a well-administered election is important. So, you know, administrative problems can occur. If parties really don't want this system to work, they can tell their supporters to just vote for them and don't give any second choice votes. And we have had situations in Australia where the main parties decide to do that to try and basically starve oxygen from the smaller parties. It's not a smart strategy, because if you get to 48% and you just needed a couple more, you know, second choice votes, and you've sort of cut off your ability to reciprocally get any, then you're a loser. But it does happen sometimes, and it may happen, it may happen here. I mean, I'm not sure that the parties in Maine, from what I've heard, have yet adjusted their campaigning. Right? So it may not have the sort of impacts we've had in Australia. Again, we've been doing this for so long and the parties have become so adept, but this is a first time round, so it's not going to be like that the first time. So I'll just say this. The other thing, that there is a history of using this system in some parts of America, if you go back far enough. But what happened was the losing parties would sometimes, when they got back into power, would then try and repeal the system. So that's another danger, I guess. Yeah. All right. One more question, apparently.
I was just going to ask you, did you know that it was by a citizens' initiative that it got it?
Oh, yeah.
The legislature. No,
we've been watching this.
To get rid of it.
Yeah. We've been watching this process. Yeah. Look, we've been watching this process very closely, including in Australia. In fact, the night of the second ballot,
People's
referendum. I was sitting. It was daytime for me, of course. And I'm on the other side of the world. I was sitting there for a couple of hours, just watching the votes come in. It's like, because I was like, wow, this is actually going to happen. This is amazing. It's what has happened here. It really is not just for nerds like me, but I think this is quite historic. What's happened? So, as I said, I don't have any political, but I just hope it goes well. I mean, I hope the November ballots go well, run well. I think that would be a really good thing. Thanks very much, everyone.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Dr. Ben Reilly, Dean of Sir Walter Murdoch School of Public Policy and International Affairs in Australia. He recently joined the League of Women Voters of Maine at the Bangor Public Library to talk about ranked choice voting. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it at our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Hour Alarm Clock and Ghost Island. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.